You're listening to the Lawyer Lifestyle Podcast with Chicago attorney Dave Scriven Young.
It's Tuesday, so that means another Legal Power Players episode. Every Tuesday, I bring to you an interview with someone who's in power in the legal industry or someone whose superpower is in marketing, sales, and leadership. Today, I'm excited to have Amy M. Stewart on the show. Amy is one of the founding partners at Stewart Law Group, PLLC, a minority and woman-owned litigation boutique in Texas. Amy's area of legal practice include labor and employment litigation and alternative dispute resolution, commercial litigation, product liability, and ERISA-related work. Amy's background as an NCAA Division I conference champion, women's basketball coach, has provided her as an understanding of how to build teams, develop, implement, and execute successful game plans, including motivating others to higher levels of performance and creating an atmosphere of teamwork. An established leader, Amy is focused on you, your business, and your successful outcomes. So, Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Amy, I did want to talk a little bit about your personal background. Your bio indicates you were an NCAA, championship basketball coach, and I know you're originally from North Carolina, so I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of, the context of, how you got from North Carolina to coaching in the NCAA.
Okay, great. So I grew up, I was born at Camp Lejeune. My dad was in the Marines. And then at some point when I was 5 years old, we ended back in the mean streets of High Point, North Carolina, where I grew up. And I was good at a couple of things. I was academically gifted and could dribble a ball really fast. And so because of those two things, Wake Forest said, we'll recruit you and give you a scholarship. So I ended up going and playing basketball at Wake Forest. And I remember being on the bus coming back from a game my senior year. And I was like, what does life look like after collegiate athletics? And because I didn't know, I did the easy thing. And I went to, I coached at Wake Forest and then I coached at Tulane University, which is in New Orleans, obviously. There was no alcohol involved at all, right? So from there, I decided, you know what, it's time to maybe grow up a little bit. And so I became a consultant for the NCAA. And through that process is how I met my husband. And then after that, I was in Missouri, and my husband worked at the University of Missouri, and I was doing pharmaceutical sales at this point. And God must have heard me, because I did not like this job. And I was talking to one of my doctors, and the doctor said, why are you doing this? And I said, I want to go to medical school or law school. No, excuse me. He said, you should go to medical school or law school. And I said, well, I don't like the sight of blood, so that narrows it down. And so literally 9 months later, I was in law school, and my husband then got a job at the Big 12 conference here in Dallas, Texas. And that's how we got to Texas in 2006.
Well, let me unpack that a little bit. So, I mean, it sounds like a really long journey to law school. Tell me a little bit more about your coaching career and your basketball playing career. I imagine there's a lot of things you learned as a coach that would be transferable to what you do as a lawyer.
I mean, the older I get and the more that I am training young attorneys, the more value I find in my athletic experience. There's so many intangible skills that you learn as an athlete and as a coach that transfer to being, because I'm a trial attorney. I like to be in the courtroom. I mean, this thing that we do every day is called the legal practice. And I'm a litigator. And so you could practice legally for a year and a half before you have any substantive hearing or trial in a case. It's the same way, it's analogous to playing a sport. We would practice all week for one game. And that game is the most important game when it comes up. It's just like when you get prepared for trial. Like you can, the legal practice, you are doing everything, discovery, all that to get ready for trial, and you get one shot at trial. That's all you get. And so that's just one of the things that I learned from being an athlete, that it takes a long time to get ready for that one big game or that one big trial that you have. And so you have to be patient. You have to be diligent. You have to work hard on day one, just like the day before you go to trial. And I think so what I'm hearing there is, you know, we're talking a little bit about work ethic, dedication to your craft. And that's really transferred a lot for me. And it's what I try to share with my associates.
And what did you learn in terms of leadership as a coach? Obviously, you know, you, I don't know if you own your own practice, you probably have a smaller partnership at your firm, but I'm curious as to, I know that you take a lot of time to mentor your young associates. And so I'm curious as a coach, as a basketball coach, what skills did you learn there that now you apply to teaching and mentoring your young associates?
So we have a saying at the firm, know your role and be a star in your role. And that comes completely from my sports background. And so I have a short story about my experience with a couple of players. So we went through a psychological personality test with our team 1 year. And we had a player that we wanted to be our point guard. And she kept saying she wanted to be our point guard. And we went through that test and we got the results. And the results said, she doesn't want to be a point guard. There's nothing in her personality profile that says that she is that type of leader. She is more of a assistant or, you know, like plan B, but she's not plan A. And so when we talked to the gentleman that did the test, he said, she's just telling you what you want to hear. She doesn't want to be in this role. If she's a two guard, she's going to flourish because she can support. She's a good supporting player, like a Scottie Pippen to a Michael Jordan deal. Michael doesn't win the championship without Scottie. And so when we moved her to being a two guard and they shared the leadership role, we were successful and she felt more energized and there was more value there because she was playing to her strengths. Same team. We had a player who was an amazing athlete, but we wanted her to be a vocal, verbal leader. And that's did the test. Skill set came back. She's a leader by action, not by words. So as soon as we took the pressure of her communicating and leading team functions, she flourished as well. And so what I take from that is that you've got to take each associate by who they are, and you really have to spend time with them to understand what they really want to do with their life. Like, you know, I can't make a bunch of mini Amy's. Maybe they are better at discovery. I hate drafting discovery. There are people that love that. That's be the Scottie to my Michael Jordan. I'll be the Scottie to your Michael Jordan. And find out what role they play where they can excel and they can play to their strengths. And then define their role for them. And then they will be a star in their role. What I see a lot in the legal profession is that we are just churning out associates and we're not trying to figure out what do they want to do. And so I really, with my associates, I try to figure out where they fit in our game plan in regard to what areas of the law do they need to be focused on versus other things that maybe they don't want to go and argue at a hearing. Not that they're scared to, they just don't want to. And that's fine. I can find another role for that person on my team. So you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And what I find most interesting is I can tell you that in my, 17 years of law practice, I don't think I ever had a conversation with a partner of a law firm who asked me those questions. And I think that's very rare, Amy. So I think it's wonderful what you're doing. And it's a great message that I think we all need to share, that we really do need to have conversations with folks. Because I think we always, I think it may be two things. Number one is, you know, young lawyers may not know what they want to do when they get out of law school. But number two, I don't think people really feel like they have the time to spend to ask those questions for an associate. And what I'm hearing you say is that it's crucially important to the legal team that we find time to have these conversations.
Yeah, I mean, again, being a former athlete and coach, I'm all about building teams, and you have to have synergy among that team. And you can't bring anyone along unless you know something about them. And what I tell my associates and the up council that work for me, what do you want to do when you grow up? Now, just like a kid, that could change daily. You know, one day my 15-year-old daughter wants to be a veterinarian. The next day she wants to be an anesthesiologist. It the spectrum. And so I'm always trying to connect with my people on a task and asking them questions about what do you think about, you know, drafting those discovery responses? I hate it. Well, everybody hates it. So, you know, you just got to keep working at it, become, you know, do a good job at it. But maybe at the end of the day, that's not what you want to do. Maybe you don't want to take depositions, or maybe you do want to be the person to take depositions. But I think you have to connect with your people, or they don't know you care. And I do feel that sometimes in the legal profession, because of the legal business model, that it kind of inhibits our ability to build those relationships with our associates. And I also think that that could be a reason why minorities leave the profession the way that they do, because they already come in and they're maybe the only one, the only woman on the litigation team, or the only Latina or African American or Asian or whatever. You already have some imposter syndrome, and then no one's really trying to figure out who you are and what you want to bring to the legal profession. And so I really try to be cognizant of that, because I remember how I felt when I was a young attorney.
Well, let me ask you, and I wanted to find out your perspective on women in athletics, especially college athletics, because I know there has been a, at least in my mind, you know, as a white guy, it seems to me there's been a shift in college athletics, and I'm sure you've seen it over that period of time. But I'm curious as to the situation of women in college athletics, and then looking at women in the profession, minorities in the profession, in terms of, you know, how do you make your mark when you feel like you may be a second class, you know, mm-hmm. citizen.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people in college athletics kind of feel that way, and I'm sure women in the profession feel that way as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. So, you know, I remember being a student athlete, and so I played back in the 90s, and I remember that was not you didn't want to tell anybody that, because they're going to think you're a dumb jock, or the only reason you got into Wake Forest is that you could dribble a basketball, you know? And so I remember not even telling people, like, I wouldn't lead with that. That's also analogous to, I talk to and try to work with a lot of women veterans, and women veterans do not lead with the fact that they have protected our country and served our country because of what they believe people are going to perceive about them.
Wow.
But if you listen, if you think about the skills that college athletic women bring, and women who have been, you know, served this country in the military, you have work ethic, you have, you know, discipline, you have that they're obviously they can execute a game plan or a military plan. All these things that the last time I looked, companies, law firms wanted to hire. And so, you know, the thing that I lead with now, I mean, my brand is about, I have leaned into my brand, which is that what I bring to the table as a trial attorney is the same type of, when you're watching the WNBA or any other athletic event, that's how I'm going to play the game of this litigation. I'm going to be all in, and we're going to have a game plan. We're going to execute it. We may take a couple of losses. We're going to wipe our knees off, get back up, keep moving. And, you know, and that's kind of how we approach it. And then we're not going to stop until 0-0-0 is on the clock. And, you know, the more I have embraced who I am authentically, the more success I've had at developing a firm and developing my book of business. I mean, because I have to tell you, you know, for 12 years, I was trying really hard to be the very best old white man I could be. And guess what? It just, the look just didn't work for me. And so finally, when I decided to be me is when all this success, and I mean, obviously with hard work, has really come to me, because I think people are drawn to authentic people.
Yeah, that's great. And it's a great segue into sort of a branding discussion. And I did notice, and, you know, doing a little bit of research for this call, that there are a couple of Amy Stewarts in the Dallas area.
Yes.
And it's important to distinguish between another Amy Stewart and yourself, who is Amy M. Stewart. I wonder if you could tell just a story about, you know, running into that Amy Stewart and your friendship that you've developed over time.
So Amy Elizabeth Stewart is an amazing attorney in Dallas, and she handles insurance matters. And so years ago, I was not aware, because I'm not sure if Amy is from here or not. I'm not. And so we show up in 2006, and I remember getting a bunch of phone calls to me at my old firm. I was at Cox Smith, or it's Dykema now. And I got a call one day, and I was talking to this Southern gentleman. You could tell from his twang. So I didn't catch the name at the beginning. So I'm trying to catch if this is an uncle that's calling me. And then finally he said, "You're not my Amy, are you?" And I said, "No." But by that time I was aware that there was another Amy Stewart. So I had her phone number right beside my phone, because I get calls all the time for her. And so from that point, I was like, I've got to meet her. So I just talked to her dad. And so the Dallas Morning News at one point did an article about the two Amy Stewarts. And so they focused on my sports background, and they focused on her being, I mean, she's a prolific writer in regard to insurance coverage. She's written a treatise that is the go-to treatise here in Texas. And she's an amazing person and an amazing mom. And I consider her a sister. But we showed up in the same networking group. Like two people invited us to this networking group, and then we're in the Brady Bunch Zoom squares, and there's Amy Elizabeth E and Amy M. And, you know, we just roll with it. She gets my transcripts. I get, you know, people call me and want to hire her. I just take her matters. I mean, that's just what we do.
That's great. It's fantastic that even though what could be seen as a competition between the two of you is actually, and both of you kind of, as you said, roll with the fact that, you know, things happen, and it sounds like you're all very friendly about the whole thing.
Yeah, she's got a very distinctive brand, and she uses the color green, and I have a distinctive brand, which is kind of a sports feel. And I was with a client, and she said around Christmas, she goes, "Thank you so much for the pears." And I was like, green. Those came from Amy E. And so she started laughing, because I could have just said it, but the green pears don't match with the sports theme. And so I didn't roll with it. But even, I mean, things like that. Another time, my husband takes me out for Valentine's Day, and we walk into the restaurant, and she goes, "Happy birthday, Miss Stewart." And I'm like, "It's not my birthday." And she goes, "Well, I have it right here." And I told her, and I said, "Now there's thousands of restaurants in Dallas." That one night, Amy shows up for a birthday dinner with her friend. And I told the hostess, I said, "That'll be the other Amy Stewart." And she's like, "No way." 20 minutes later, here comes Amy E.
Amazing.
I know, it's crazy.
small world. So yeah, I mean, it goes to show you how important having a brand message is. But, you know, not only in case there's two of you in the same jurisdiction, but also so people can know who you are. As you said, you know, being authentic is what clients are looking for. They're not looking for just, you know, run-of-the-mill, you know, attorney. They're looking for someone with a little bit of personality, someone that they can connect with, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So let's shift gears a little bit to sort of a marketing conversation and a rainmaking conversation, because as you know, my listeners can tell, you know, you're a very successful attorney. You have a firm that supports you know, many associates, and so I think a lot of people will be interested in finding out sort of, you know, what your keys to success, if you will, for developing those clients. And the thing that I preach sort of on this podcast is that there are so many ways of marketing your practice. But that you really just have to find what works for you, and sort of like, you know, if you're a speaker, then you should maybe go live, or if you're a writer, then you should do a blog and that sort of thing. So I'm curious as to what your, you know, what are some of the things that you enjoy doing while marketing? And then also what has been sort of your most successful sort of marketing initiatives?
Yeah. So I think everything in life is, when you boil it all down, is about relationships. And I know people get tired of that. Yeah, whatever. But it really is about relationships and you showing up as your authentic self and getting to know people and letting them get to know you. And every time I speak, I put a shout out for Brené Brown, because at some point she's going to reach out to me or something. You have to be vulnerable through the process of developing business. You know, you have to be okay with asking someone to have a drink or go to lunch, because at the ultimate, you want to make an ask to get their business. And that vulnerable part, even when I'm talking to you about, you know, David, let's go have a drink and talk about, you know, what keeps you up at night. Even me saying that to you gives me butterflies in the stomach, because you could say no. Right. If you're a client. And so first, you got to be authentic, and you got to understand this process does require you to be vulnerable. And you have to figure out what your individual game plan is to how you're going to generate business. Again, in the legal profession, sometimes we get so cookie cutter about everything that you will look at an older partner and how he generated business. And guess what? He generated business because he went off on he was as a member at a country club and he played golf. Well, I mean, I could play golf, but I don't want to be outside that long, right? And I've got a kid and I can't do, so you can't do it that way, but there's got to be another way that you can build these relationships. So, I mean, the way that I did it was I came to Texas in 06, and it was clear that if you went to SMU or UT or Baylor and all that, and everybody went to school with each other, that they were giving each other business. I went to University of Missouri, Columbia, and then dropped into SMU for my last semester. And we didn't know anybody. And so my plan was, I'm going to get involved with the ABA and Marty Truss, who's a partner at Dykema now, and Deborah Williamson, you know, really were advocates for me to get involved with the ABA section of litigation. And so I started going there and going to their meetings and meeting people outside of the state of Texas, so that when they had matters in Texas, they thought about me. And, you know, everybody outside of Texas is scared of Texas. So, you know, so they would either send me, not everybody, but the people I made built relationship with would send me the work, or would call me and ask for a referral. And then through the ABA section of litigation, I've tried to find leadership opportunities where I could write and I could speak on different things. And even when I was a young lawyer, I was trying to generate content, which now is so important, because every single bar association needs content, because virtually and everything, and for the websites, new fresh content. And so I would just draft things about, as a young lawyer, what are the things that I'm learning? Or the Texas Supreme Court would come out with opinions, and I would be like, this is why this case on breach of contract, you should listen to it. And because I had a connection with the ABA section of litigation, I got my stuff published all the time. And after building that relationship at the ABA level, then I started building relationships in Dallas, because I had a little bit of, oh, she's involved with the ABA section of litigation, so she's got to be the real deal. And I started moving up in leadership with the ABA section of litigation. And then I kind of transitioned that to being more state bar of Texas work, and then local. And I got my connection to be on the litigation council for the state bar of Texas from the ABA section of litigation. And I was sitting beside my mentor, Paula Hinton, who's at Winston Strawn. And she turned to me in her Alabama Southern twang. And she said, I'm going to call on you at some point to do something. And you just need to say yes. And she called me and said, I want you to be on this litigation section council for the state bar of Texas. And I said, yes. And then I'm on that. And so, again, none of that happens without building relationships and moving from the firms I've been at. It's all been about relationships.
Well, it's interesting because, as you know, I'm also involved in the ABA section of litigation. Actually, that's I don't know if that's how we met originally, but I think a lot of people discount getting involved in larger bar associations, and they think, well, you know, it's just a national group, and I can never get clients or get referrals from those folks. So I wonder, you know, we've attended a lot of meetings in our professional lives. What are some tips that you can give folks, you know, for people who are thinking about, you know, hey, well, maybe the ABA, you know, litigation section specifically is right, is or is not right for me. But what are some ways that you can sort of get involved and make sure that you can really, you know, you're going to spend a lot of time at these meetings. What are the best ways to efficiently use your time when you're at a conference or a meeting, especially with the ABA?
Yeah. So you and me have this in common. We have a lot of stuff in common, but one thing, and we were talking about this before we started, you are a doer, and you just are not going to show up anywhere and someone give you a new matter. I mean, you've got to work it. And so with the ABA section of litigation, there are, I've lost count at how many subcommittees there are with different specialties that you can, there's pretrial discovery, there's a business torts, there's in-house, there's all these different subcommittees that if you want to get plugged in, they are looking for people as subcommittee chairs. And you don't have to have any experience with the ABA section of litigation. They're just looking for doers. And what do those doers do? They draft articles. They put together roundtables. They do webinars. They do sound advice. They do all this, create all this content. And guess what you can do if you're a subcommittee chair and you're creating content for the ABA section of litigation? You can partner with the corporate counsel group and meet corporate counsel and get them to partner with you on creating a podcast, creating a webinar, drafting an article about the top five tips of the best deposition prep or whatever. Again, all I'm talking about is building relationships with people, but you have to, you're just not going to show up. You got to raise your hand and say, I'm going to handle that. And you would be amazed at the doers who elevate pretty quickly through the ABA section of litigation because there's so much work to be done. And then when you start moving up, then you start hanging out. Now you've spent months, sometimes years with people. They know you. They know they're going to see you four times a year at leadership meetings and the big ABA meeting and the corporate counsel meeting you're going to go to. And so when you show up, people know you, then that vulnerability you felt first walking into the ABA section of litigation is gone. And then guess what? People, just like in any other environment, people start introducing, hey, David, you know Amy? Yeah, we did this, that, and other. And then it becomes easy. But the beginning part is hard. You have to be vulnerable. You have to go to the website. You got to say, you know what? I really like fraud and business tort type work. I'm gonna email the chair of this committee and say, I want to work on the social media subcommittee, and then get to work.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic advice, because I think especially young lawyers, that they hear, you know, oh, I need to get involved in a bar association, but I'm afraid to do it because, you know, there are so many people that are much more experienced than I am. There are people who have written more articles than I have, that done more trials than I have. So what do I have to offer? What would you say to people who have that kind of thought going through their head?
It's not true. So there was a saying in Becoming, or Michelle Obama talked about, you know, you have this imposter syndrome, and that is not just for racial minorities. That's for anybody that's walking into a room and they don't know anybody. You feel sometimes, I don't belong in this room. I don't belong as a leader of the ADA section of litigation. But what you do realize, as she talks about, once you get to the table and you look to the left and the right, you always think this. What took me so long? I can do what he's doing. I'm a better speaker than she is. Same thing happens to me outside of the ABA, but you know, I go down to the courthouse when we could do that, and I watch the great trial attorneys in Dallas County, and I look around and I'm like, I can do that. So for any young lawyer listening, you can do it. And you have to push through, going back to that vulnerability word, that you have to push through that. You have to call out what you want to do. I want to be the social media chair for the Business Torts Committee, or the, you know, Business Commercial Litigation Committee. You have to claim it, and then you got to do the work for it. And I promise you, at the ABA, doers are rewarded. And you elevate quickly, and you can go back to your firm and you can say, I am now subcommittee chair of the Business Torts Committee. And I've written these articles, and I've got this webinar going, and I've invited this in-house counsel to speak on a webinar with me on that. That is what business development is. It's just building relationships and figuring out how you can use that to help other people.
What I've also seen within the section, Amy, is a very welcoming attitude to mm-hmm. new people, and especially to younger folks.
Yeah.
Because I think everyone sort of realizes, we were all young once. Mm-hmm. We all were kind of feeling, like you just described. And I can tell you, I've been in the section for, I mean, I guess my entire legal career, but really only became involved in the last maybe 5 years as a leader. And I was actually very pleasantly surprised at how welcoming people are, you know, especially like you said, sort of like the thing that I love about the section, frankly, is that you really get like the most preeminent folks mm-hmm. in the litigation field that come to talk, you know, at our conferences, and that are the leaders of the section. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at how open and welcoming those folks are. And they welcomed me, you know, with open arms and gave me stuff to do. And as you said, I'm a doer. So people mm-hmm. give me stuff to do, I'm just going to do it. And I'm going to do it to the best of my abilities. And I think it served me well in the section. But you're right. I think people are very, very willing to give folks things to do, for sure.
I would not have my firm without the ABA section of litigation, full stop, because they gave me a vehicle to create my brand when I was a young attorney and I was just drafting stuff, trying to figure out my way, what area of the law that I want to do, and just found my way. Another thing is that I know, I don't think this comes from my athletic background, but maybe it does, or maybe it's because I came to the profession later in life. I wanted a leadership role of some sort, and the ABA section of litigation allowed me to do that. I mean, I started the social media committee for the business torts group. So you get to use those leadership skills that sometimes you don't get to use at the firm because you're a baby lawyer trying to figure out what you're even doing. But you can go to these ABA meetings and exercise those leadership skills in that arena. And every single year, and then people will say, oh, it's so expensive. Oh, this or oh, that. It is the best money I spend. And I look at the money every single year when I'm like, ooh, which bars am I going to join again or not? But every time I look at that bill for the ABA sexual litigation, I think if I don't go, I don't get to see Anne Marie Seibel or Barbara Dawson or Paula Hinton or Beatty O'Donnell, or I could just a long list of people across the country that I would never met. And then I sign the check and I send it in because those relationships matter. And you've got to work it. You've got to work it. You got to do.
Absolutely. I noticed that one of the programs that you were involved in recently with the ABA section of litigation was on, I believe it was on, you know, remote trials sort of in this, you know, COVID-19 quarantines, and we're all doing work from home, and we're doing maybe not in Cook County, but in other places I know that there have been, you know, trials and that sort of thing by Zoom. And I know that you've had a recent experience in doing one of those trials. And I wondered if you could tell us just a little bit about, you know, what that was about, how it was doing a trial by Zoom, and, you know, what your feelings on that are.
Yeah. So we have a case, and it's still pending. It's a dispute regarding a commercial property, and there's $6 million they're, you know, seeking in damages. And I represent corporations or the company, or as my daughter says, the man. So I'm always on the other side of the V. And so we got a call, it would have been at the end of April, from a retired judge that manages this, it's called in Texas summary jury trial process. And so it's a part of the ADR process in Texas where in person, normally, the jurors that the court requires you to go through this process to see if you can settle it. It's kind of like an educated mediation where you, if again, you're going live to the courthouse, the jurors that don't get selected for real trials, you get to use them to select for your summary jury trial. And it's six jurors. And then what you do is you select the six jurors, just like any type of voir dire that you have, jury selection. In Texas, we call it voir dire, and we say it just like that. and you select the jurors, and then you do what I call a super closing argument. That's got, you can direct exam witnesses, cross-exam witnesses, use deposition excerpts. You can do whatever you want within that hour and a half presentation, as so long as you agree with the other party what you're going to do, what exhibits you're going to use. And so plaintiff does his presentation, you know, you do your presentation, and then you give the case to this jury, and then they come back and they tell you about the case, whether the highs and lows, what themes they like, they didn't like. And then you roll from that into a mediation with the retired judge that's heard everything. Because I don't know about you, but I get tired of going to mediations and no one's taking anything seriously until 2 p.m., you know, after the lunch. You know, the mediator finally has figured out what the facts of the case are, even though you sent them a mediation statement. But I digress. So in April, we get a call from the judge that manages the process. And he says, we're going to take you guys to a virtual summary jury trial. And we were like, no. We have an order from the judge right here that says we're doing it in July. And he's like, nope, she's issuing an order and you're going to do it in 3 weeks. We're like, okay. So now I've got to tell a corporate client that you're going to be the very first corporation to go through a Zoom jury trial process. They didn't take that too well, but we got through it. And so we had to get ready. And what did that look like? I was just up to speed on what Zoom, how to share documents over Zoom. And now I got to have exhibits and witnesses and all this stuff. We made it happen. And so, but some weird quirky things that happened through the process is that we weren't aware until the Monday of the event, that Monday morning, that it was going to be Zoom. It was a Zoom proceeding that was going to be fed live over YouTube.
Oh boy.
So, because our understanding is the entire process was confidential because it's ADR.
Right.
It's supposed to be driven to mediation, but the voir dire selection part was live. We found that out that morning. the Friday before we found out that we were actually doing voir dire, we were told that the judge was going to do it. Then we were told, no, judge isn't going to do it. The parties are going to, the council's going to do it. So we handled it. And so we did the voir dire, which was really interesting for so many different layers and levels. Like, for example, did not consider the fact that I'd be looking into these people's homes. Mm-hmm. You can gather so much intel about someone by looking at their surroundings, right? I did not anticipate that everyone would pay attention, and they did. I didn't anticipate that, unlike a regular jury selection process, I can see everybody on my screen instead of, you know, head on a swivel as you ask questions to the veneer. And so those things were interesting. The jurors absolutely loved the process. And so after we went through the voir dire, we selected the jurors. We had two sets of six. Then the next part was confidential, and we did the hour and a half presentation. Plaintiff did a good job of telling their story through two witnesses. I got to cross-examine their expert in my part of the case. So it wasn't like a regular direct and cross-examination. The expert came out, he testified, he went back into his break room. And then as a part of my presentation, I'd now like to call such and so to the stand. He popped back in. I did my cross-examination. He went back out. And then we finished, and then it went to the jury, and then they came back, and then they told us, you know, what they thought about the cases, the themes, and all that stuff. I mean, I did not want to do it, obviously, but I'm so glad that we got selected to do it, because it sharpens your skills as a trial attorney to have to do it over a virtual platform.
Yeah, you're a pioneer, Amy. I love that.
I don't know about that. I got through it.
Well, I wonder, I mean, I've never done a trial or a hearing over Zoom, and I imagine a lot of people haven't, but this is going to be something that, as this, you know, pandemic continues and quarantine will continue, courts are going to have to administer justice somehow, and it's going to be virtual. So I wonder, you know, what tips you might have, or I hesitate to ask you about your mistakes, but I wonder if there are things that how you prepared, and you know, how the examinations went, and what tips you might have for people who are going into a jury trial or hearing or what have you by Zoom.
Yeah. So if it's any presentation that you're doing over Zoom to a judge or to a mediator or to a jury, I think a couple of things. First, I think there's a heightened level of professionalism that you have to show virtually than you have to do in person, just because of the casualness of the platform. Like, you and I are both at home, and so we already feel a little more casual. So you have to up your professionalism. And how do you do that with a Zoom platform? You've got to know it inside and out. You got to know how to share the document. You got to know how, if you're sharing the document, how you can make it bigger or smaller, or how you scroll. I mean, you've got, like, you have to know how to use the platform. The second thing is that you need to think about it like you are producing a television show. Yeah. And that was one thing that we did through voir dire, and as well as the confidential super closing argument, as I call it. My voir dire, what I wanted to do is, like, I wanted to channel Oprah. You get a car, you get a car, you get to be a juror, you get to be a juror. And so the whole time I am engaging the squares so that they're talking to me and answering each other's questions so that I can learn and actually watch them instead of having me talk the whole time. And so, like, for example, I would tell a story, and then kind of like the Oprah or the Phil Donahue's of the world would have that microphone and go in the audience and go, what do you think about this? And so I would ask the question, and then I go, well, David, what'd you think about what Molly just said? So that it was more of a production, because the one thing that you asked about mistakes is that you can't have any dead, quiet time on video. And the reason I say that is that if I stop talking, people think their internet went out or, you know, something where, you know, you've got to have a, you've got to be visually or audio stimulating them the entire time. Or they're like kids, they're going to look away or pay attention to something else. So those are the two things that I would say. You've got to know the platform. You got to be ultra professional, even more so. And you got to think of it like a production. Even when with witness prep, I've had a bunch of prepping witnesses for depositions. I've literally had them take their laptop and walk around their house to figure out where the lighting is best. And then I say, where are you? And they go, I'm in my kitchen. I'm like, sit down. Can you sit right there? Is there a chair? Can you move a table? Because you look better right there with the lighting. And you've just got to do that. Because this is this whole new platform. I had a sanction hearing yesterday. A sanctions hearing. That's an important hearing. And opposing counsel was showing exhibits like this. Just putting up a sheet of paper to show the judge on the screen. And he literally, I guess, refused to figure out how to use the share function on the Zoom. We're in a whole new world. You can do that in court, I guess. But, you know, you've got, I take my job very seriously. I just was like, there's no way I would ever do that to a client. I'm still thinking about it. I'm like, I cannot believe he just held it up. Anyway,
I can't either.
I know. Anyway,
I wonder as maybe just kind of as a wrap up question in terms of technology, and were there any technological hiccups? The reason I ask is because I was on a status hearing. We were discussing, you know, what the judge might want to do on a motion via Zoom. And I felt so bad for this one attorney that was on because her internet kept going out on her. And literally, I mean, there was nothing that she could do. She just had a bad internet connection. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, you know, were there any sort of technological hiccups during your trial? And how did the judge or arbitrator, mediator deal with, you know, those types of things?
So we had Judge Emily Miskell out of Collin County. It was like the IT guru of Zoom. And so she had done a great job of knowing how to move the jurors around to different breakout rooms when it was necessary. So we didn't have a lot of hiccups from that perspective. There was a funny part where, you know, they had done a lot of communicating to the jury pool about, do you have a laptop or a desktop or a tablet, or are you going to need to use your phone? And one young woman showed up and she had her phone, but she couldn't figure out how to get it onto portrait versus landscape. And so at one point during the proceeding, she literally was upside down. It was an older woman and she was upside down because she kept twisting her phone. And so she was literally spinning on the feed. And so you're just sitting there like, poor thing. And so that was interesting. But we didn't have any, what I did to make sure that I didn't have any issues is that, you know, I have a daughter and she plays Fortnite like every other teenage kid does. You know, I was just like, for the next so many hours, you can't play because there's just so much internet. And I made sure to turn off the TVs that are feeding off of the internet just to protect and make sure I just sucked up all the internet during that time period. But I had talking about a status conference, I had a weird one last Friday where I'm local counsel and I wasn't let into the hearing. And so I'm sitting there for like an hour and a half, like, man, her docket is crazy. And then all of a sudden I get an email and they say, Ms. Stewart, can you please get lead counsel back into the hearing? So now I'm like, there's a hearing going on and I'm not there. Like, what's going on? And so then I hit the link and I show up and here's the federal judge and her clerk looking at me going, we need to speak to lead counsel unless you want to answer this question. And I'm like, I don't want to answer the question because I'm local counsel. And so then I could not get lead counsel back onto the Zoom. And she says, just hold the phone up to the computer And so he can, and she was like, Mr. Such and so, can you hear me? And so literally my heart palpitations, because I have no idea what's happened for the hour that they've been in the hearing. And now I'm holding a phone up to my screen so a federal judge can hear my lead counsel.
That's an outstanding story. That is, I mean, those are the crazy times we live in, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yesterday I had a sanctions hearing, and whatever reason, my Zoom camera didn't want to work. So I had to, you know, even though the judge is talking and I'm going out and I'm coming back in and they still can't see me. And it's like, well, you just gotta roll with it. And finally got my camera to work and everything was fine, but it's just a crazy world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I feel like we could talk all day about yourself and about all these issues, but I just really appreciate you coming on and being my guest. And I wonder if folks, because I know you have a very unique perspective with respect to young lawyers and mentoring young lawyers, if anyone wanted to reach out to you, just to, I don't know, catch a cup of coffee by Zoom or just to speak to you by phone or email, what's the best way if folks wanted to reach out to you that they could do that?
I think probably the best and easiest way is you can just type Amy M. Stewart, Lawyer Dallas, into the Google, and it'll take you to my LinkedIn page or take you to the website, and you can find me that way. Or you can always email me at A. Stewart, that's STEWART, at stewartlawgrp.com. Either way, probably the best way would find me on LinkedIn.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, again, thank you so much, Amy. Really appreciate your time and for the great stories and the great words of wisdom for my listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me.